Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
Last plate was fucked up. Last record was fucked up. Make a new one. If it's dope, everybody forget about the last one.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 165, a talk with Jarobi White. Jarobi is, of course, the mysterious fourth member of a tribe called Quest. He founded the group along with his childhood best friend, Fife Dog. Jarobi appeared on the group's debut album, People's Instinctive Travels and the Paths of Rhythm, in a sort of tour guide role, introducing the world at large to the group's revolutionary vision. After that, his role in Tribe was somewhat intermittent, contributing ideas in the studio, showing up for some performances but not others, and generally keeping people guessing about what he was up to. During that whole period, and continuing until today, Jarobi was also pursuing his other passion, food. He is an experienced cook who has worked as a private chef and in Michelin-starred restaurants. He currently runs an events company called Eats, Rhymes, and Life that brings together his passions for food and music in live events. We talked with Jarobi via Skype. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. After you do that, make sure to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another man with a passion for music and food, author Dan Charnas, on episode 64. Charnas actually features Jarobi in his brand new book, Work Clean, The Life-Changing Power of Mise en Place to Organize Your Life, Work, and Mind. Also consider helping The Cypher by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just a dollar a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. For September, we're working on putting together something great for you. Become a patron by September 16th at noon Eastern to get access to the file. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, a man who learned his geography from Red Fox, here's Jarobi White. So the first thing I wanted to ask was something I kind of stumbled on last night in the wee hours doing my last bit of interview prep here.
Right on.
Is it true that the initial inspiration for El Segundo actually came from Red Fox?
Oh, yeah.
What's the story behind that?
We were big Sanford and Son fans back in the day growing up. And Fred Sanford always used to be like, hey, Lamont. He'd be like, hey, Pop, what are you doing? Lamont, why don't you sit down here and have some of this food? I'm going to sit here and watch Godzilla Eats El Segundo. It's a double feature.
It's a great picture too, son. Gork fights a giant cyclops. See, if Cyclops was losing, he cried. Tears fell in the Pacific Ocean and caused a tidal wave in El Segundo.
You have $4,000?
Are you crazy?
Well, what are we gonna do?
I think we should wait until it's dark and head for Elsie.
Elsie who?
El Segundo.
Like, you know what I mean? So, like, we thought it was some imaginary place because you always be like, Godzilla eats El Segundo, such and such an El Segundo. Take that back to El Segundo. So we thought it was like an imaginary place because it sounded like some far out, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We use that as a song, you know, as a metaphor for a far off place.
I left my wallet in El Segundo. Left my wallet in El Segundo. Left my wallet in El Segundo. I gotta get it. I got to get it.
We didn't know it was a real place. Our first trip to L.A., we're getting off the airport. You know, El Segundo's right by the airport. We see the sign that says El Segundo. We're like, oh, my goodness, El Segundo, it's a real place.
That is too funny. Mm. So you grew up in the Bronx for a little while before moving to Queens. You were in Co-op City for a while, which back then was pretty heavily Jewish area. What was that kind of like to grow up around?
Absolutely. I took Hebrew. Egg creams and bagels and bialys and that stuff was a part of culture. Matzo ball soup, like, it was part of my culture. Didn't really seem like it was any differentiation. Like, one of my best friends, Jeffrey Zimmerman, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it didn't even, you know.
That's great. Where did you take Hebrew? Do you remember?
In school.
Oh.
It was one of the classes offered in school.
That's great. And you went to Queens. You were about, what, 11 or 12 when you went to Queens?
Yeah, 11, 12.
What was it like going to what probably felt like the suburbs?
No, it definitely was the suburbs. My parents moved me out of co-op because it started getting rough back then. You know, 82, you know what I mean? 83. Mm-hmm. It felt like the equivalent of being put out to pasture. Oh, my goodness. What is this place, you know? All these trees, my allergies are bothering me. Oh, my goodness. Like, so, you know, it was... I guess that was the Jewish influence. Oh, my allergies. It was really different, you know, just going to Queens. It was a little quiet and not as active.
But then for high school, you were at Brooklyn Tech in kind of the mid-80s. What was that like over there?
Like going to Vietnam. I went in 84, the height of the crack era, the beginning of the crack era. So I was traveling from Queens, those same suburbs, those good old suburbs, to Fort Greene, Brooklyn. And Brooklyn Tech is located across the street from Fort Greene Park, which is across the street from Fort Greene Projects. You know what I mean? So it was kind of rough going to school every day.
I bet. You know, right around this time, you know, you're in high school, you and the guys from the group are kind of making your first demos, 83, 84.
Yeah.
Some guys from maybe 10 blocks away start blowing up, start making albums and becoming stars. What was the inspiration like? What was it like for you to see Run DMC kind of get big?
It's crazy because it made everything seem real. Like, oh, we could do this. These guys are down the block. They're superstars now. You know what I mean? They're like becoming the biggest stars in the world. It's like, man, we could do this. We can, you know, we can do this. We can rap as good as them, you know?
Yeah. Nice. And you even had an early song kind of in their style, right? Called Routine, which I tried like hell to find in advance of this and couldn't. It's been scrubbed from everywhere. You're laughing. What do you remember about that tune?
I totally remember. It was total Run DMC ripoff. I was doing a beatbox. Tipping and Fife for rapping, and the guitar was like, like it was like some real rock riff or whatever, and it sounded like a Run DMC song with beatbox.
Amazing. Do you have it anywhere still?
Nope.
Well, maybe it'll show up one day on the box set.
Hope not. No, kidding.
Musically, a big influence for you was the Force MCs, back before even they started really singing and were the Force MDs, back in kind of when you were first coming up. What stood out about them?
The routines. Mm-hmm. Their routines and their harmonizing ability, even before they started really singing, their routines. And they took a lot of the TV shows of the day and made them into... raps.
When it comes to rapping, we'll have your feet a tapping, we'll have your hands a clapping. We call the Force MC, rocking the Force MC. The Force MC, it's the Force MC. Okay,
come on, MC, we're rocking, listen,
what we got to say.
You know what I mean? They're I guess to give a correlation, they would be like the Weird Al Yankovic, but the hip hop Weird Al Yankovic. They would take songs, existing songs, and redo them in a hip hop way.
Mm-hmm. And LL, right after Run DMC blew up, he kind of got big too. Was he from nearby?
Absolutely. He lived on Ilion, which was like two blocks away from where Tip lived.
And so he kind of became, you know, a solo star at that point. What was that like to see?
Well, that was even crazier because he was closer to our age. You know what I mean? Like, you know, running those guys, those are our big brothers and older cousins. But, like, L is, like, our contemporary. You know what I'm saying? So it was like, oh, man. You know what I mean? But by that time, 86, we already were in high school, you know, making demos, getting close to, you know, having our stuff played on the radio at that point.
You know, that actually leads me to a question about getting into production. I know, you know, initially the beats were you beatboxing, and at a certain point, Large Pro comes into the picture, right, and starts talking to Tip about production. How did that connection happen?
I'm not sure how that connection happened, but Tip and Ali were already... Okay, Tip was already making... starting to produce.
Mm-hmm.
What we did, we made pause tapes back in the days. Have you heard of pause tapes?
Yeah.
So Kendra, tell us how you started producing.
I started doing the shit like on some pause tapes. I don't know if a lot of niggas really know. I may be dating myself. Growing up, the shit, you know what I'm saying, niggas ain't really had access to a lot of shit, but usually you had your mom's tape deck record. It was like the cheap joint, the Samuel joint.
Yeah.
You put a record on.
Yeah.
It was the dual cassette shit.
Yeah,
okay. You had to do the dubbing, right?
Okay.
So what niggas would do, like, you know, if it was a beat, you know what I'm saying? You know, you just extend the shit. Like if it's the long red beat, you're out there. I would pause the shit and keep doing the shit. It would take forever.
So, you know, we were making pause tapes, and that was our thing. Making the pause tapes, and Tip was probably one of the best. Tip in Africa from the Jungle Brothers were probably the best people at it that I ever saw. They would, you know, make these pause tapes, and it would sound like a song. It would be so consistent, you know what I mean? It would sound like a song. And that was our first introduction into producing. And then we got I think they pulled their money in and got a 4-track that everybody shared and started using that. And Large Pro came about, I'm not really sure how that happened, but yeah, Large Pro came in with the SB. I know he, under Paul's tutelage.
Right, this is Paul C.
Yes, everybody learned how to use the SB-12.
Did you meet Paul C at all?
Nope, never met him.
For more information about Paul McCaskey, a.k.a. Paul C., check out episode 147 with Anton Pukshansky.
And so, you know, you guys start making demos, and then, you know, via one of Tip's high school buddies, end up connecting with Red Alert. What effect did he have on your career?
Oh, man. it was crazy for me because I was a little young. I'm a little younger than those guys, so I'll be going to school 11th grade. And on Friday, you know, those guys will go to the studio, make a song, and get it played on the radio the same night. You know what I'm saying?
Wow.
You know what I'm saying? So that was crazy. And then we would, you know, Jungle Brothers start doing shows because our house shoe took off. And we would be doing, like, going with them and doing, like, 4 shows a night. You know what I'm saying? We go to hit Jersey, hit something in Harlem, hit something down, hit something in Brooklyn, and then hit something downtown or downtown. Like, you know what I mean? We would do this, like, every weekend. So, you know, that was crazy to be, you know, that influence and being with Red and just seeing how everything operated on a level that most hip hop people probably at that juncture didn't have they didn't have that access to Red Alert. You know what I mean? Because Red Alert was the biggest thing on the planet. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just that he was my boy's uncle.
Red Alert goes
berserk.
DJ Red Alert, who is the uncle of Mike G of the Jungle Brothers, was one of, if not the most influential DJ in hip-hop since the early 80s. He broke acts such as Tribe, Queen Latifah, and Black Sheep, and also played a pivotal role in the Bridge Wars, being the first DJ to play South Bronx by Boogie Down Productions.
You know, and our uncle, you know what I'm saying, it was nuts.
Yeah. And around this time, you know, 87, 88, Ali's uncle gets a copy of an album, an early copy of an album.
Yes, sir.
Before a lot of people had heard it. What do you remember thinking about Easy Does It?
I remember Ali being like, yo, you guys have to hear this album. And we're like, well, he's like, from these dudes from Los Angeles, California. We're like, what? You know what I mean?
Yeah, they make albums out there?
Yeah, so he put this on and... I think the first song on that album, if I recall correctly, is The Boys in the Hood.
A remix version of Boys in the Hood is actually the fifth song on Eazy-E's 1988 debut album, Easy Does It. However, the original version of the song came out as a single in 1987.
I think that's the first song on the album. And to hear the bells, dun, 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 And we heard that, and the hand claps come in. The boys, and then we hear Easy's voice. The boys in the hood are always hard.
Cause the boys in the hood are always hard. You come talking that trash, we'll pull your car. Knowing nothing in life but to be legit. Don't quote me, boy, cause I ain't said shit.
I'm like, what in the hell is this? Because up until that time, there was reality rap, kind of, sort of. You know what I'm saying? That Flash and Melly Mel was doing, or what have you.
Broken glass everywhere. People pissing on the stage. You know they just don't care. I can't take the smell. Can't take the noise. Got no money to move out. I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room.
And then it's like they took Run DMC style, which was hard as hell, like, you know what I'm saying? And just totally gangsterfied that shit out. And this is like 86, I think, I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm.
85, 86. And then the beautiful, beautiful profanity. You know what I mean? And we were like, holy crap. And their production level was on some next level shit to us.
Yeah.
Oh, we were like, oh my God, we have to do better. You know what I mean? We have to do better.
And oddly enough, you got to see Compton not only maybe a year or two later, right? Your very, very first show outside of New York.
Yeah, yeah, it was crazy. KRS-One, Boogie Down Production, they were our label mates. You know what I mean? And Chris already was going to every hood. He was well-established going to every hood in the country, really. You know what I mean? So we did this show in Compton. It was at Compton College for Compton Day. Or something to that effect, and KRS-One was headlining, and we opened up, you know what I mean, and we had heard all the war stories. Hey, don't wear red, don't wear blue, like, you know what I mean. And we get to this location, and we're in a camper on like the football field, and there were it seemed like a million people there, but this may also be my 17-year-old mind too. It seemed like there were a million people there, you know what I mean? And they had a clear delineation in the middle. Red and beige on one side and blue and gray on the other side, and the cops down the center. You know what I'm saying? And dudes are throwing gang signs back to each other while they listen to the music and shit like that. We're like, what the entire fuck is this, man?
Amazing.
I've never seen anything like that, you know, up to that point in my life.
Yeah. And I wanted to dig into kind of the dynamic of Tribe for just a second. When people talk about you in relation to the group, this phrase comes up a lot. You're the ideas guy. You're the ideas man. You're the inspiration. But, like, what does that actually mean?
I don't know. Unless you're an artist and unless you work in a group dynamic, it's really hard to understand like how that shit works. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, I guess from an outside person, if you don't really know about music, you say, okay, written by, produced by. But that's not really how it works. If you're friends and you're in a room and, you know, you're making a song and somebody's like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and gets stuck on a line, somebody might yell out, oh, no, such and such and such and such. But, oh, yeah, let me write that. Blah, 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 blah. Oh, you remember the other day when blah, 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 blah? Like, you know what I mean? So I just think that I helped to, I don't know. I just helped with ideas and stuff, I guess. I don't know how to explain it. It's like everybody was involved in every aspect of the music. So, you know, that's why it always says written, produced by A Tribe Called Quest. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's why it's never singled out. You know what I mean? Tip is the guy on the machine. Actually on the machine. And, mm-hmm. You know, Ali will put some rubs. You know what I'm saying? Or I might be like, oh, no, use that record for that. You know what I'm saying? Or Fife like, oh, put those horns. You know what I'm saying? So that's how it works.
Mm-hmm. And did that spirit of collaboration change as time went on and, you know, the group got more successful from, you know, the second, third, fourth, fifth album?
I think that as Fife started rapping more, he started concentrating more on rhyming, and his Tip got better, you know, to the genius level that he is with music. I just think that the focus, everybody honed their focuses in on certain aspects.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But it was still the collaborative spirit, though, always.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know you were kind of most involved in the first three albums, kind of the ones that everyone talks about as being most classic.
Yeah.
Which of those was your favorite to make, like the to be around and to be in the middle of the process of, and why?
Ah, that second album, man. That Low End Theory, man.
Back in the days when I was a teenager, before I had status and before I had a pager.
Go all out. Somebody been saying, shorty black, you're bugging out.
Zulu Nation, mother's last creation. Minds get flooded, ejaculation. Right.
You know, you have your whole life to make your first album. You know what I'm saying? Up until that point.
Yeah.
But that second album, B, you have a finite time of a couple of years, maybe 8 months or whatever. You know what I mean? It was like up until that point was like a big learning experience. You know what I mean? And then the second album hit and Fife came into his own. And then everybody's familiar and kind of knowing what to do and what the process entails and stuff like that. You know what I mean? And I just think the leaps that were made. The leaps that were made talent-wise, subject matter, like everything was really dope to be around.
Mm-hmm. And how did you, I guess, right around that period, you know, you recorded some stuff for that album that didn't end up on the final versions of the songs. Why was that? Why didn't your verses end up there?
Because I had went to culinary school and started concentrating on culinary school. And I would, you know, everybody, you know, we knew that was probably wasn't going to be able to support. Number one. Number two, I was young. I was really young. And I think the pressure of doing all those things, I wasn't really ready mentally. You know, I wasn't really emotionally ready to deal with all those things, too. So that was another reason to make me take a back seat as well.
Do you regret not having your vocals end up there at all?
Absolutely not.
Mm. Interesting. This is the thing that, you know, you've been starting to talk about over the past year or two, but, you know, puzzled a lot of people, both outside and inside your orbit, I think, was, you know, 91, right at this time, you know, the group releases their second album, they've had, you know, hits already and some success, and you leave their orbit to, not entirely, but, you know, as a sort of full group member to go to culinary school.
Mm-hmm.
How did... You've talked about why a lot, but how did people around you react when you did that?
I thought I was fucking crazy.
was that tough, having everyone not really understand your decision?
No.
No?
I don't work like that. Like, fortunately, like, the guys within the Native Tongues, like, we're, like, real friends outside of music. Like, you know, our commonality is music, I guess. That's what brought us together. But we've developed real friend relationships, you know what I'm saying? And people sincerely cared about people. So, like, you know, people made decisions that may not have been the best music decisions or whatever, but may have been the best personal decisions. And everybody has, for the most part, have been, like, super supportive of everything that everybody has done.
Mm-hmm.
And family-wise... I think they felt like, oh, fuck, oof. He came to his senses. You know what I'm saying? My parents are all, like, educators and professional people and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, you know, me even doing the music in the first place was ridiculous because I got good grades and they wanted me to be a doctor and shit like that. You know what I mean? So
yeah. And as the group went along and, you know, there was a little bit of internal strife, and I know Fife at some points got a little dissatisfied.
During the recording of Tribe's album Beats, Rhymes, and Life in 95 and 96, Fife Dog began to lose interest in the group. Looking back on the situation some years later, he said this, quote, "By the time when Beats, Rhymes, and Life came out, I started feeling like I didn't fit anymore. Q-Tip and Ali had converted to Islam and I didn't. Music felt like a job, like I was just doing it to pay bills. I never want my music to feel just like a job. They would schedule studio time at the last minute. I'd catch a plane from Atlanta to be in New York, and when I got to the studio, no one would be there. They would have canceled the session without telling me. Seems like the management was concerned with other folks, not me."
You guys were really the tight ones. You guys were the ones who had been best friends since you were 12 years old. Did he ever feel like, hey, man, where'd you go? I really needed you when stuff was hard in the group?
I wasn't there for Fife.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Because even during the recording of Beats, Rhymes, and Life, when he first moved to Atlanta, I went with him. You know what I'm saying? So there wasn't really no, you know. And I always went on tour too. You know what I'm saying? I always went on tour. So there wasn't a real, there wasn't that situation. No, there was times where things were going down in the heat of the moment. He'd be like, yo, I wish you was there, man. If you was there, such and such would have been different. It wouldn't have went like that. But like, you know what I mean? But he didn't, I know he wasn't really happy about my decision to do those things, but that's my brother, and he loved and supported me. He wanted me to do whatever was going to make me happy and shit.
Yeah.
And like I said, our relationship was what it was. It was beyond music anyway, so that didn't have nothing to do with anything.
Right. And, you know, one final thing about those early days of Tribe before we get more into, you know, what you've been doing now and your career business-wise, you toured with early incarnations of a couple groups that people would come to know better on later, or...
Mm-hmm.
You did a couple shows, I think maybe 89, with an early incarnation of the Ghetto Boys, right? Then Willie D was in the group.
Yes, when Reddy Red and Reddy Red, I think Scarface was DJ Action still.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember about those guys?
To this day, Scarface is a very, very good friend of mine to this day. Like, you know what I'm saying? That was a really cool meeting and situation because he's one of the most special, talented, beautiful human beings on the planet.
He's also a guest of The Cypher on episode 104.
And I met him and fucking Bushwick. I fucking loved, I loved those dudes. Like, it was cool, right? Because
Bushwick was a dancer for them or something, right, back then?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was a really cool experience with them. I have a really awesome Bushwick Bill stories from that tour. We were in, first time we went on tour with those guys, it was Harvey, Illinois. They were wild, you know what I mean? And it's funny, hip-hop is a really weird thing because there's these guys, you know, people make different types of music. Different parts of the country, you know what I'm saying? And then you meet these people like, oh my gosh, what are they gonna be like? And you get to meet these people like, oh, they're just like us. Like, you know what I'm saying? There's no different. Like, you know what I'm saying? There's really no difference. Like, wow, this is so cool. That was one of the first times I think where I understood that all of these major cities must be kind of similar.
And what happened with Bushwick? You said there was a story there.
So Bushwick, the girls used to love Bushwick. You know what I'm saying? Groceries like him. And, you know, I fancy myself, you know, I know my way around women too. Like, you know what I'm saying? So there was this time where, that was our commonality. So we were like talking to girls and stuff like that after the show, what have you. So we get back to the hotel. So we invite a whole bunch of girls to the hotel. So there's like 20 or 30 girls running up and down the hotel, our hotel floor or whatever. So every once in a while, I hear a knock on my door, and it'll be Bushwick. Like, yo, my ass opened the door. Like, yo, what's up, man? What's up, man? And he'd be like, go ahead, ladies. And he would have girls, like, reciting his raps and shit like that. They would know his rhymes, and they would recite his raps. And I would think it was some funny shit. He'd be like, okay, do you want me to leave them here? Or you want me to take them with me? I'd be like, yo, leave her, take her with you. Leave her. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's funny. So 2:00 in the morning, I guess, you know, our neighbors on our floor, they just couldn't take it no more. I get the knock on the door from security. Okay, you guys get your shit and get out. Like, you know what I'm saying? So they threw all of us out the hotel. So we were, it's like, out hotel-less in Harvey, Illinois. I think we wound up getting on the bus and just going to the next city or whatever. But that was really, really funny. We had enough fun for us to get kicked out of a hotel.
Amazing.
And... you know, that was me, 18.
Mm-hmm.
So I was awesome at 18 years old.
I'll bet. And speaking of people you met when they were dancers, you encountered Pac when he was Digital Underground.
And he's going to say that. Pac, like he personally, he became a good friend of mine from those times. You know what I mean? Because we would go on these tours and... the lead singers would hang out with each other, You know what I mean? And then the B-tier guys would hang out with each other, and there would be us guys, like me, the dancers, like, you know what I'm saying? So, like, I hung out, you know, I got to hang out with him a lot. Like, and it was dope. When I first met Pac, he didn't say nigger. You know what I'm saying? He didn't say bitch. Like, you know what I'm saying? He was like ultra, 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 ultra Black Power panthered out. You know what I'm saying? And then he was still a thug, though. Like, you know what I'm saying? Son was a thug, though. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, that was always one consistent thing.
Yeah. Actually, a story came up about him the other day being on tour with Public Enemy and earning a spot on their bus because he beat down some guy who, like, stole their clothes or merch or something.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly, exactly. It was cool because now when he gets the part for Juice, you know what I'm saying? He's in New York now. So now he's calling me. He's like, yo, Jay, what's good? I'm like, yo, what's going on, man? He would call me 9 o'clock in the morning, like, yo, man, you know, where can I get a blunt from? Like, you know, so I'm like, dude, it's 9 o'clock, B, it's 9 o'clock. So, but you know, man, he's cool. Like, he's you know, beautiful dude, another beautiful spirit.
Yeah. And you know, Tribe, their final tour until the, you know, next round of final shows a decade or so later, the first final tour was like 98.
Right.
Can you describe how you were feeling? You're like, you know, 26, 27, this thing that had been, you know, a huge part of your life since you were 12 years old, basically, is coming to an end. Like, you're still a young man, but this giant thing is done. Like, what was your mind state at that point?
Well, for me, to be honest with you, I think I was a little younger, and I think we started rapping, like, really, really young, like 12-ish, you know what I'm saying? So, like, to be honest with you, I didn't really think that we would be doing this past 25, 26. You know what I mean? Because there was no point of reference, because who was doing it past 25, 26? So I didn't really think that anyway. So we're like, okay, well, it was time to go. You know, nobody didn't really want to admit it at the time, but it was time to go, you know. The separation had caused the quality of music not to be the fucking same, whether anybody wants to agree with it or not. Like, you know what I'm saying? It was still good music, but, you know, it wasn't the same. What made us Tribe wasn't Tribe anymore. So it was time to go. You know what I mean? But, you know, Tip and Fife, you know, I definitely encouraged them to do solo shit. You know what I'm saying? There was an incident, as a matter of fact, on that tour where me and Fife hopped off the tour to do those songs, those first Fife's first solo songs that he did with Jay Dilla,
mm-hmm.
JD. Those first songs that he did with him, like Bend Over. I can't remember.
Do you like it like this? Are you ready? Are you ready for this?
Jay Dilla produced both the A and B sides of Fife's first solo single, Bend Over and Thought You Was Nice.
Freshly dipped when I get down, you're OB. Tell him about the puppy named Mutty. Hot lifestyles galore in case a chick wanna hunt me. I'm gotta represent with the correct mind frame. Since Tip and Dale, I put me on hip hop, it's never been the same. My eyebrows lift when Tip was shot.
He also produced Four Horsemen 192 in it, which appeared on Fife's 2000 album Ventilation to LP.
I'm the man of my hood. I thought I tortured that. Don't be nervous. You're worthless. Be all you can be. That nigga's better off joining a service. Don't hustle, you're a baby. Why don't you sell garbage? 12, 12, 58.
More recently, a Dilla beat was used for Fife's posthumous 2016 single, Nutshell.
The undefeated, unblemished, underrated, unfiltered, unafraid, unaffected, undaunted, unabashed, the undeniable, untouchable, unstoppable, unusual, underdog.
We jumped off and went to Detroit to start recording them. Got stuck in Detroit because of the snow and got back late to the show in Philly. And I think we got back last two songs. But Fife had knocked out four songs with Jay Dilla. That was so amazing. But we got back late. And that was an issue, of course.
I can imagine. And so, you know, while all this is going on, you're working restaurant jobs, you know, even during tours and stuff. But then, you know, the group is fully over. You transition more fully into, you know, cooking. And, you know, there are a couple of gigs that stood out to me during this period. One was, you know, after you left South Carolina, you moved to Atlanta, you worked as a private chef. What was that like? What was that environment?
It was the easiest shit I've ever done in my life. I would go to this fucking rich-ass guy's house. make meals two times, three times a week. And Sunday, we'd have a thing, and that's some outside thing. You know what I mean? Some get together. You know what I mean? On the weekends, which were really insane because I met this guy and I didn't really fully get or understand who he was. But it was funny because, like, I'd be there cooking and Natalie Cole would come over. You know what I'm saying? Or I'd be cooking and Steve Harvey and his family are over there now. Like, you know what I'm saying? But the best one, I'm cooking one day and I hear this voice saying, "What does a New York dude know about making some fried chicken?" And I look up and it was Jermaine Dupri. And I was like, "Oh my goodness, dude, this is wild." I'm like, "Yo, what's good, man?"
Oh my God.
That was awesome. Jazzy Faye used to be over there too. It was insane. That was a really fun job, but it was really easy. I cashed out. I made so much money, but it wasn't that long lasting.
Was it weird when people would say, like, "Hey, what's a member of Tribe doing cooking at our dinner party?"
Not everybody knew I was cooking. I think, well, I don't know. People knew I was cooking. I don't know how. I don't feel no way about it because, to me, I'm still doing what I love to do anyway. Mm-hmm. So it was no big trade-off.
Can I ask who the guy was you were cooking for?
Yeah, his name was Lee Najjar. And he was famous because, I guess it's over now, I could talk about, I don't know, but I don't care anyway. You remember that show? Housewives of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
Big Papa, the secret boyfriend.
Wow. Okay. You know, one other job you had actually also in Atlanta was at the Flying Biscuit.
Yeah.
What were your conversations like with the Indigo Girls about, like, music? And did you guys talk about music and cooking?
I never met them. I met them, but it wasn't in an environment where I had a personal conversation with them.
Mm-hmm.
I was so disappointed about that.
Yeah, you would have thought they would come through their new restaurant to, you know.
You know, I didn't know, though. Like, I didn't know that, you know, they were a part of it until late on in the process. Because I was moving from South Carolina at that point because my wife had lost her job as a teacher and found a better one in Atlanta. So, like, up. I'm like, I could do what I can do it. You know, I can cook anywhere. So we went to Atlanta. Went down there. And so that was during 2006. But it was Rock the Bells. So during my training, I would be doing my training during the week and then doing Rock the Bells on a weekend. So my coworkers, you know, the people in the company were like, "What the who the fuck are you?" Like, you know what I'm saying?
Like playing 80,000 people on your day off.
You know what I'm saying? No, you know, Thursday would come around, Friday, Thursday, whatever day it was, you know what I'm saying? And then the SUV comes, pick me up, takes me to the airport. And they're like, "What the fuck?" Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, what? So there was this guy, I'll never forget him. It was Jeffrey. That was my dude. He did the baking. He did a lot of the baking for the company. So I had to do training because they, you know, it was a corporate gig. So I had to learn their way to do things. So he was the baking guy. So he was like, "So my friend was in San Francisco and she said that she saw you in San Francisco. She said, didn't you say you worked with some guy named Jarobi? Well, there's some guy named Jarobi here, like blah, blah, blah." And I started laughing. I was like, "Well, yeah, you know, I'm Tribe and blah, 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 blah." And he was like, "Oh, so you're a regular Hannah Montana, aren't you?" And I fell out. I fell out. I didn't know who Hannah Montana was at the time. You know what I'm saying? So I had to research. You know what I'm saying? And I saw Hannah Montana and I started dying laughing. I'm like, "That's so funny." I was like, "Oh yeah, I'm the rap Hannah Montana. Sure."
Amazing. Can you tell me a little bit about the guy you call your Yoda, Shorty, Josh Eden, how you met him and who he is?
Wow. I was, like I said, I was living in Atlanta at the time, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, these guys are my friends. So I came up, you know, I had to go see my dude Tip, you know what I'm saying? So I came up one time and we went to dinner. And we're having dinner. He's like, "Yo, I got to take you to this restaurant. This dude is so ill." I'm like, "Word." So we go to the restaurant, and the Shorty's restaurant. He's had it in Village, in Soho. restaurant in Soho. And met Shorty, and he made this beat dish. And I was like, yo, how did you get those beats like that? Blah, 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 blah. I started talking to him. He's like, what are you, a chef? And I was like, yeah. He's like, ah, okay. So he sits down, and we're talking, whatever, and we just became cool. You know what I'm saying? And he's like, well, where do you work? I'm like, well, I'm kind of in between. I'm looking for something in Atlanta right now. He's like, oh, I have some friends in Atlanta. Let me try to hook you up. He tried to do that. It didn't work out. A couple years later, I get divorced and shit, and I'm moving back to New York. So Thanksgiving, it's my first Thanksgiving back in New York. So me and Tip are having lonely boy Thanksgiving by ourselves and shit. And then Josh comes and brings some food. Shorty comes and brings some food. And he's like, yeah, man, I just got this new place, man. Whew. I wish you were here. I could use some help. And I was like, guess what? I'm here. And he's like, oh, yeah? It's like, well, when do you want to come in and start working? I said, tomorrow. But it was Thanksgiving, so I had to wait until Monday.
Right.
So, and then he started fucking whooping my ass then that next Monday. And Shorty comes from you know about the insane lineage that he comes from. Jean George.
Eden worked for the French chef Jean-Georges Van Gerichten, who has opened eateries in Las Vegas, London, Paris, Shanghai, Tokyo, and more, as well as New York's famed Jean-Georges restaurant.
He was Jean-Georges' hired assassin hitman for a number of years, opened, I don't want to say, 20 upwards of 20 restaurants for him all over the country, in China, all kind of crazy shit like that. He's a beast. He's a monster. Like, you know what I'm saying? He's a really, really talented guy and an excellent teacher.
I was going to say, you know, you call him Yoda in part, you know, mostly because of you said he really didn't take it easy on you when you first got there. He didn't, you know, he wasn't like, oh, this is my new, you know, rap star / chef.
Oh, no. Nah, I got the beatings. Like between the lines, I got the beatings. He's always been my friend and nurturing, like, you know what I'm saying, as a friend and shit. But like, oh yeah, between the lines, I got beatings because I've learned. I came before then. I was a chef, you know, chef and title meaning that you run the kitchen. You know what I'm saying? But like the finer aspects of fine dining and fine food and stuff like that, I wasn't really, you know, I had no idea the depth of it. You know what I mean? I was just a guy who could make things taste really good. So, you know, he refined how I worked. You know what I'm saying? He helped me tap into all of these things about myself, my talent that I really did not know about. You know what I'm saying? And he showed me a lot of things, you know, hit me to, you know, all the methods and all of those things. Like, he helped me really refine my game. And I got the taste and experience of being a real New York chef. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, being a New York chef is something, it's a total different animal. It's a total different game. The chef's club here, it's hardcore. I'm not taking away from chefs anywhere else in the world because they're all super talented, but it's just it embodies New York. The grind and the hustle and the energy of New York is just embodied in all the chefs and shit. So being here and be able to do it on that level is some next shit.
Yeah. And, you know, you started a events company.
Yes.
Eats Rhymes in Life, it's called.
Yes.
And have a couple big events. What made you want to, you know, get out of being in one specific kitchen and do more of kind of the food and music themed events?
I think it came out of necessity. Me and Josh Shorty were at August together for about 3 years. You know what I mean? Our lease had expired, so, you know, they transitioned to another location. So in that transition, you know, I had to, like, really think about it. I'm like, okay, do I go back and work with Josh still again? Like, you know what I'm saying? That's not, you know, that doesn't really seem right. Do I get my own place? You know what I mean? I'm like, that's going to take a lot of money and time that I really want to, you know, want to do with. And then I went to L.A., I went to Club Aphex and Adam 12 was DJing and I got pretty drunk, you know, just pretty, you know, having a great time. And I'm like, yo, Adam, why, I'm hungry, man. What I get something to eat? You know what I'm saying? And he's bothering him, kept bothering him. He's like, yo, go in the back, they have tacos. I was like, what? He said, go in the backyard and they have tacos. So we're in the club. So we go in the backyard and have tacos. So I'm sitting there with a drink, eating tacos, and to the music at the same time. And I'm like, yo, this experience is fucking amazing. We do not have this in New York. And I'm like, So I stayed there for a little longer. And then somebody else is like, hey, it's Taco Tuesday. It's Taco Tuesday. Everybody's making plans for this Taco Tuesday thing. I'm like, what is wrong with you people? You're just tacos and it's just Tuesday. But, and I started catching the wind of the phenomenon. So I understand. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. So I get back to New York and I'm thinking of events. You know what I'm saying? Because I had, I went to LA to do a guest gig with Roy Choi.
This was the remixing menus idea?
Yes. So the remixing menus idea, remind me, I'll come back to that, I guess. So I was out doing Roy Choi event.
Roy Choi is a Korean-American chef who gained prominence as the creator of the gourmet Korean taco truck, Kogi. He's one of the founders of the food truck movement and served as the inspiration for and consultant on Jon Favreau's 2014 movie about food trucks, Chef. He currently runs several Los Angeles area restaurants.
And so that's how I discovered the Taco Tuesday thing. I come back home and I'm like, okay, that was cool. Traveling, how can I, you know, work this out? And what do I do in the meantime? So I get back home and I'm like, somebody puts up this post that says Tribe Tuesday. And I was like, oh, you guys are making it too easy for me. So like, boom, Tribe Taco Tuesday, put it in my neighborhood. You know what I'm saying? And I'm thinking like, okay, this will be something to make a, make a few dollars and to have a fun, like, you know what I'm saying? And work this satellite cooking thing out. You know what I'm saying? Not cooking in the kitchen, like work that out. The processes of that. But like, I'm thinking, okay, it's going to be 30, 40 people here. No, it's 100 people. You know what I'm saying? Next week, oh, no, now it's 200 people. Now News 12 is there and Eater and Grub and all these people are there. Like, you know what I'm saying? So now this is the thing. And I'm like, well, damn, wait a minute. I was just trying to get my feet under me to see what I'm going to do. Like, you know what I mean? I didn't plan for it to be, but it's a thing. So I've been really lucky and super fortunate to do that. And within that I was like, okay, this is the model. I want to travel. I want to kind of apply the touring philosophy to cooking because that's what I'm familiar with. I know how to do that. But just put some cooking events, making events. You know what I mean? I didn't really intend to make an events company. I'm just a chef, but it made sense to make the events company because that's what we're doing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And what was the remixing menus idea that started this whole thing off?
The remixing thing, that started the whole Eats Rhymes of Life. That's why I named the company Eats Rhymes of Life, because of that concept. Hip hop came about because the backlash to gangs. And there was a need for kids to have some kind of, I don't know how to term it, but community involvement with each other, for kids to do together besides trying to kill each other. You know what I'm saying? So that's how the hip hop thing came together. And so within those people, people who had musical talent or musical aspirations came out of that. But in New York City, that was like the decline of New York City in the 70s, and all of the sports programs and music programs were being cut out. So the inventive people that we are, we started taking pieces of already existing music and forming it and shaping it into a totally new composition. You know what I'm saying? That is a hip-hop aesthetic. You know what I'm saying? Because you may take a Christian Dior blouse and put it with some Levi jeans and some sneakers. Like, you know what I'm saying? And that's hip-hop. And I wanted to, it just made sense to me to apply that same philosophy to cooking.
Mm-hmm. So you would take the menu of a well-known restaurant.
Right. And I also knew by doing that, they would be probably more likely to let me in to cook because they don't have to buy any new ingredients. Everything that they have is already in-house. You know what I'm saying?
Makes sense.
So, yeah, that's what I came up with. Just, you know, whatever's there. Whatever raw materials they used, whatever their ingredients were, wherever the meats was, I would just come and just use that shit and just flip it and make some new shit out of it.
Right. And there's a couple things around this events company and you that I wanted to get into. You know, your whole life, you've had this kind of in and out relationship with the spotlight, with attention. You know, you're a member of a successful group, you know, maybe the greatest rap group of all time, but then you leave it. You're there, you're not. You're doing this thing that gets press attention, but I know you like privacy as well. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship with the spotlight, with attention from the public and press, like how you feel about it, how maybe your feelings have changed about it over the years?
I hate to say this because I don't want people not to pay attention to me and shit, but I'm getting more comfortable with it now, but it's always made me super uncomfortable. You know what I mean? It's always been an aspect of the shit that I really didn't understand or really didn't want to be involved in. I get its purpose now. You know what I mean? But I just always felt that like self-promotion was yucky. You know what I'm saying? Self-promotion is like, it makes you, ugh, you really need that much attention that you gotta force people to pay attention to you? Like, you know what I mean? I'm like, no. You know, and I like to, I'm just like, I'm not shy, but I'm just not really open with myself like that. You know what I mean? And I've had to learn in this incarnation, you know, I've always had the shield and buffer to have those guys around me, and me also not being the main dude in the group. You know, people didn't really want to know about me anyway. Like, you know what I'm saying? And that was super cool. I was totally cool with that. But I know in order to grow this company properly and to myself, you know, to grow myself properly, like, you know what I'm saying, I have to go through these things, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. For the sake of promotion and for the sake of advancing myself as a human being, you know what I mean? Because it's a thing, you know what I'm saying? I have to conquer it, you know what I'm saying? It's a fear or apprehension or something like that. You know, I have to handle my business, you know what I'm saying? For my development as a human being, I have to handle that. So, like, it's daunting. You know what I'm saying? But I'm getting to enjoy it a little bit, I guess.
Well, good. I hope it's not too torturous.
No, I see the use for it, and I totally understand it. And also, for the people that support me, I have to give of myself. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So, like, you know, yeah, I have to do shit.
Yeah, and that actually brings me to something about the events themselves, which is, you know, people show up for the food, they show up for the DJs, you know, but they also show up in part to see you. So how do you balance the actual physical act of cooking with greeting the people and making them feel like, you know, you've given your time and attention to the people who are coming to see you?
Yeah, because, like, one of the reasons of my appeal to the cooking in general is because I'm sitting in the fucking in the kitchen and nobody's bothering me. Like, you know what I'm saying? But having to share of myself is crazy to me. Like, you know what I'm saying? And having the understanding that, okay, they're not just here to eat the food. They are actually here to see me. You know what I mean? Because it's always been like, okay, I'm in the place and they want to see us. I'm a part of what they want to see. And the focus has never been on me. So that's like an interesting wrinkle that I'm, you know, learning to deal with now. And the dance, the balance is really, it's difficult for me, man. Because, like, I want to be directly cooking the shit. But I know as a chef, that's not really my job, number one. Mm-hmm. That's not really my job.
Right.
And number two, but I also understand that people want to see me. People want to get handed a plate from me. You know what I'm saying? They want to get the plate from me. And then after they're eating, they want to come and talk to me about it.
Right.
So it's like, right. Fuck, man. Like,
that's a lot.
It's a lot. But I love it, though. Like, you know what I'm saying? I'm starting to I guess flourishing it now, like, you know, basking in, I guess, like, you know what I'm saying? It's still super fucking uncomfortable, but it's a sacrifice that I have. Well, I don't want to call it sacrifice because it's not a sacrifice. It's something that I want to do for people who want to see me, want to be involved that much. I want them to be involved, and I feel like I should give myself. I should be open to it.
Yeah. And in past interviews, you talked about wanting to start a food truck. But I know recently you'd gotten some discouragement from surprising sources, right?
Yeah. I don't want to, like, disrespect the food truck business, because that's not what it's about. You know what I'm saying? I just think they were speaking to the level and the time and work that I put into this being a chef and the level that I need to be or whatever. The food truck is not really the thing for me because it takes too much time. It takes too much time. And people are on food trucks like 18 hours a day and stuff like that. You know what I mean? And, mm-hmm. and food trucks are for kind of for people who are like starting out. And they can't maybe not secure the finances to get a restaurant or something like that, or don't have the notoriety and stuff like that. And I have all of these things. You know what I'm saying? And they're like, why you wouldn't, that doesn't make sense for you to start there.
Mm-hmm.
And I get it. But yeah, it was something that was fun that I wanted to do. And maybe when I open my brick and mortar, I'll open one or use, you know, as a satellite location, maybe. My idea for the food truck, honestly, was to capitalize on a touring situation again.
Right.
Because I know if I put my damn Jarobi truck at Coachella or any festival or whatever, it's going to draw attention. You know what I'm saying? And that was my idea to do it. Because I'd be like, we fly, put some music in it, what have you. You know, make an experience.
Yeah. Do you have plans on doing events outside of New York and L.A.?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah? Anything in the works specifically now?
Have a Miami joint, DC, Seattle, Texas, a couple places in Texas. Like, we're moving. We're starting to move now.
Nice. And are they all going to be either some version of the remix or of the Tribe Taco Tuesday idea, or are there other
events
planned?
See, Tribe Taco Tuesday is a different animal. That's my event. You know what I'm saying? I do Taco Tuesdays. I only reason I did it in LA with Roy is because Roy, that's a special, that building, Pot Commissary, the hotel, that feels like my home. Like, you know what I'm saying? They've extended like home status to me there. So, you know, so yeah. But Taco Tuesday, I'm kind of stingy with Taco Tuesday, but all the other concepts, you know. Yeah, the restaurant remixes, barbecue, summer barbecue series, all of those things I'll do anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I may do a Tribe Taco Tuesday somewhere else too, but you know, maybe in DC, because DC is like home to me too. So maybe DC, but that's something that's really close to the vest for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, you let something slip there a second ago about, you know, when you have your brick and mortar. Any, what's going on with that?
Damn it.
I wasn't going to let that slide.
I see. At some point, you know, at some point that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
In New York, or that's to be determined?
I'm all of the guys that I admire, they have restaurants in New York and in LA. Some of them have restaurants in Chicago. I know one or two that have restaurants down south, you know?
Well, who are your models when you look at, you know, how to open up a restaurant? I assume Shorty's one of them.
Shorty's one of them because he's a beast. You know what I'm saying? Wolfgang Puck, he gets busy. Bobby Flay, you know, he gets busy with the restaurant game.
Mm-hmm.
Man, Morimoto gets busy on the restaurant game. You know what I'm saying? Those guys, I love that shit, man.
Can you talk a little bit about, so the very first time I met you was in the dining room of one of Marcus Samuelson's restaurants. I know you've done events with him and stuff like that.
Marcus Samuelson is an Ethiopian-born, Swedish-raised chef and restaurateur. He is a world-class chef, a best-selling cookbook author, and has appeared on multiple television shows, including Chopped and Iron Chef America. He has two restaurants in the Cypher's home neighborhood of Harlem, Red Rooster and Street Bird Rotisserie. The interior of the latter was designed by our episode 112 guest, Say Adams, and prominently features photographs by our episode 109 guest, Jeanette Beckman.
Can you talk a bit about your relationship with him?
Oh, yeah. Marcus was part owner of August.
August was, of course, the restaurant where Jarobi worked with Josh Shorty Eaton.
But besides that, that's funny, too. De La Soul had a website, kind of a message board website club thing called Spit Kicker back in the days. And we were all members of Spit Kicker. Well, me, Fife, and a lot of hip-hop artists, some sports people. I think it was like a predecessor of OK Player, kind of, sort of. All of us remember, it was kind of a message board just for people of like-minded to come and talk and chop it up and shit like that. And Marcus was down with Spitkicker back in the days, you know what I mean? And we used to chat back and forth on Spitkicker back in the days, you know what I'm saying? You know, nothing crazy, whatever, but we were both. But that's when I was a rapper still. So that's why I know him. And so I got to August, and I don't think that he was really aware that I worked there. And he walked by, got his food, and came back, was like, Droby. I'm like, oh shit, Marcus, what's up, man? He was like, you just made my food? And I was like, yeah. He was like, oh shit, you're good. I was like, oh wow, thank you. And that was it. After that point, we became buddies. And then we started talking events and things of that nature. And he's been really supportive. Like him and Shorty, they those guys have really like held me down in the New York scene. Like, you know what I'm saying? He's always given me a home to come there and do events and whatever he does with him. And he, you know, when he did his book launch, his most recent cookbook launch, he wanted me to come and interview him. You know what I mean? But it wound up to him interviewing me. Like, you know, it's so crazy. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
Marcus is a dope guy. He's been super helpful in my career.
Yeah. And Eats Rhymes in Life has been pretty involved in helping out with the Flint water crisis. Can you talk about that for a second?
My partner, my girlfriend, my partner, wife, whatever you want to call her, my partner, my significant other, all of those things. she's from Flint. So, you know, we were like, she went to visit a few years ago and it had problems with the water. And it was just something that we had to get involved in. You know what I mean? Do a lot of things, try to do a lot of civic minded things or whatever, and just try to pay it forward and give back to where we, you know, where we can put the energy back into the universe or whatever. But yeah, that's just one of the things that we did.
Sure. And I couldn't let the opportunity to talk to you pass without asking about, you know, Fife and his recent passing.
Malik Fife Dog Taylor died in March 2016 of complications related to diabetes.
What was it like for you to see the public outpouring of love, of memories, of, you know, remembrances of him and of his music that came in the hours and days after his death?
It was amazing, man. Like, you know, it was dope to see. Like, you know what I'm saying? Because I don't think if he really understood his importance. I don't think he really understood his importance in music and how people really genuinely loved him as much as they did. You know what I'm saying? And it was dope to see. It was dope to see people really just give him the love and the honor and the praise that he deserved and shit. And he was loved. He was loved by everybody on all corners of the earth. Like, you know, I understand it, but to see it is different. You know what I'm saying? To see it in practice is totally different. And it makes me feel cool as shit because that was my best friend and he chose me to be his best friend. So, haha, like I must be super dope. Like, if we're like, you know what I'm saying? Everybody loves my brother, like, you know, but yeah, you know, it was cool and it really helped me. It helped me deal with it too.
Sure. Did you realize that his health was so bad? Did you have any warning? Did you know that he was in?
Oh, no, hell no. Nah, he was fine. Like, I was about to send him an email when I heard that he passed. You know what I'm saying? I just saw him maybe a week before then. There was nothing wrong with him. He's running around acting stupid. You know, we went to ESPN in Connecticut.
The fall 2015 trip to ESPN Jarobi mentions here, which took place the day before Tribe's final live performance on The Tonight Show, was for Fife to appear on SportsCenter with anchor and huge Tribe fan Scott Van Pelt. After Fife's passing, Van Pelt took to the airwaves to remember the occasion.
This past fall, he came here, and this time, Fife was bugging out. He was such an enormous sports fan and sharp, not a Hollywood fan. He knew sports inside and out. And for him being here, I found out later, was his mountaintop, and he was nervous. I'm just thankful he let me step on his stage and I got to let him sit right here on mine.
A Knicks game, like he did all these things. And looking back now, these are things that I wouldn't have done with him in the past. Like, you know what I'm saying? Because he's a sports fanatic. I am too, but he's just extra. And he like forced me to come to these things. You know what I'm saying? He's like, dude, come on, man, blah, blah. I'm like, fine, I'll go. But looking back, I'm so glad that we did all those things. Like, you know what I'm saying? What he was trying. I don't know if he knew or whatever, but I'm kind of led to believe that he did know, because the way that he was wrapping business up so efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know what I'm saying? I hope everybody gets a chance to wrap your fucking life up like the way he did. He went out spectacularly. You know what I'm saying? And that gives me comfort, and that, you know, keeps me out of fucking the opium den or whatever the fuck I guess every day.
Yeah. And that, you know, a lot of the events you're talking about having attended with him were right around the time you were promoting the 25th anniversary of the first record.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that and that Jimmy Fallon show.
With a little help from the Roots, give it up for A Tribe Called Quest. Now listen, hold on.
Yeah.
I want everybody out there. When I say, can I kick it? I want y'all to say, yes, you can. You got me?
Yeah.
Everybody, get up out your seats. Get up out your chair.
Everybody.
Y'all ready? 1, 2, 3. Can y'all kick it?
And I'm so thankful for those two events.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because that brought us all together, man. That brought us back together, man, in a way that I never thought it was, you know, that I was just resigned to the fact that it was going to be how it is. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, that shit made us, it put us together in a way that, like, we're little kids. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Was that the first time the four of you had done stuff publicly since the Kanye show, which I think was like 08 or so, right? It was a while back.
What was that? 12?
12? Was it that recently? Yeah, I think it might have been.
A Tribe Called Quest opened up 2 shows for Kanye West in November 2013.
Together. We did the Stussy shit. The Stussy collaboration clothing line thing. We were together for that.
In July 2015, Stussy released a limited edition joint clothing collection with Tribe. The group's members all showed up for an event in New York City celebrating its release.
And that was cool. Everybody was cool. You know what I'm saying? But it wasn't like the Fallon shit beat.
Right.
That Fallon shit set it off. Like, being on stage together after that Fallon shit, it put us, I don't know why, but that put us, it felt different than, the Kanye shit was dope. Like, you know what I'm saying? Don't get me wrong. And we felt fantastic about that, but that Fallon shit was just some next energy shit. That was the universe speaking. Like, I don't really know. Like, you know what I'm saying? But that, you know, that was so dope. It put everybody in a place where I guess the state of everybody's life was comfortable. So it made everybody comfortable enough to come together and talk about stuff and resolve issues and shit like that. It was just so dope, man.
That's great. I'm really glad to hear that, obviously, because, you know, around the time of that the movie came out, the Michael Rapaport's documentary.
The documentary, Beats, Rhymes, and Life, The Travels of a Tribe Called Quest, directed by the actor Michael Rapaport, came out in 2011. The film received overwhelmingly positive reviews, but some group members weren't so happy. Jarobi, Q-Tip, and Ali Shaheed Muhammad skipped the film's screening at the Sundance Film Festival and went on MTV to air some complaints. There was further controversy when an angry email from a producer on the film was accidentally sent to Q-Tip. Ultimately, the group members were made producers on the film, a move Rapaport told Rolling Stone he was forced to make.
It seemed like everyone's relationship to that movie was kind of ever shifting and sometimes contentious, sometimes not. Like, from your point of view, what was the process of, like, both having the movie filmed and then the release of it?
That was the start, I think. That was the impetus. That was the start. That was very cathartic for everybody to see it. You know what I'm saying? Because when you're in a picture, sometimes you can't see it. And to see it in the way it looks, it was ridiculous. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
If the shit wasn't on film, then it wouldn't have made it to the movie. So nobody can't be mad about anything that's in the movie. But I wish that the focus wasn't on where it was, because our tribe fans are like super music nerds, are super intelligent, super savvy music listeners. You know what I mean? And it should have been more content about shit musically than our, you know, back and forth brother relationship.
Right. That definitely makes sense. And speaking of musically, you know, you put out a record a few years ago with Dress, the Evitan record.
Mm-hmm.
There was a line on there where you talked about your rhyming and you said, you know, I'm paraphrasing. You say, I try to write in advance, but I always just end up writing in the moment.
They like, Jay, I'm saying, you should practice your writing. I try, but in the moment is much more exciting. Every new bar is like ocean air to Vikings. Enticing, your shit's bland, mine's are spicy. You got nice little patterns.
Is that true, or is that something you said just for a line?
No, they say, hey Jay, you should practice your writing. A tribe in the moment is much more exciting. Every new bar is like ocean air to Vikings, enticing. Yeah. I don't write rhymes. I go in the studio, play the beat, and I like to write in that emotion of when I first hear the shit, you're like, oh, snap! I want to write there. That's what I want to write. You know what I'm saying? So, I don't have like rhyme books and shit like that.
Any chance of more stuff with Evitan?
Hell yeah. People are hounding me right now. Like when are you doing the next album? When are you doing the next album? So yeah, definitely. And Dress is, that's my brother. I love that boy. So yeah, definitely love to see him again.
And I thought it was great in the promo stuff. It was really neat to see you guys look like you were having so much fun. You know, Drez's son was involved in so much of the, like, the videos and some of the promo material.
Plus, strong, right, wrong, bright, dawn, keeping on. This is Evitan.
Right on, Sid. Right on.
You shot a whole video where you were, like, preparing some chicken.
Yeah. Because that, you know, that's the duality of my life. I had to show that, you know?
Right. So what, other than when you're filming a video, what kind of music do you listen to when you're cooking?
I listen to MF Doom, J Davy. I listen to Metal Man Ace, his son. Kazal Organism, he's my nephew. He's a dope producer out of LA.
You've done some work with
Roby spitting written words, not even a semblance of bullshit. All that poppycock you're blathering. That's why that's only OG girls and all of your gatherings. You talk a lot of fuck shit, and it's not even mattering.
I've done some work with him, and he always sends me these amazing fucking tapes, these beats and shit. So I always listen to him. You know, just the standard Marvin Gaye, Icy Brothers, Stevie Wonder, Prince is, you know, everything, you know, stuff like that.
Will we see a Jarobi solo album at any point?
Oh, absolutely. I've done a few songs with Young Guru, you know, Jay-Z's engineer.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
I've done some songs with Dinkle D from Leaders of the New School.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have a project too. I'm just like, you know, just pursuing the art in an honest way, man. You know what I'm saying? When I feel like, you know, what I feel like doing, I'm going to make sure I do it. You know what I'm saying? And I'm only going to do what I feel like doing.
Mm-hmm.
Try keeping it as honest as possible.
Yeah. And, you know, I had to ask about one of the more odd moments in your discography, which is the Jabib character, the guy on Pease Porridge.
In my land, my people don't porridge, and I don't know what's in it, but their soul is so violent, and we are so peaceful. We sit by the campfire and listen to our rituals, and they're so violent. I don't understand.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Oh, I also did that on Dress's album, too, The Cab Driver.
Where are you going?
Y'all going uptown to the pubs.
I'm sorry, I can't go there. I'm sorry.
To the Bronx?
No. I'm sorry, I cannot go.
Why not? All you gotta do is jump on the west side of the highway.
No, my meter is broken.
Give me this fine.
No. It's running too fast. My meter is running too fast.
I'll pay up whatever it says.
No. I don't want to cheat you.
Huh?
I don't want to cheat you.
You don't want to cheat?
Oh, nice.
That was just something I used to do back in the days, the Indian dude accent, like, you know what I'm saying, the stereotypical. That's just something I used to do to crack people up and shit. And everybody always wanted me to do that, you know what I'm saying? Because at that time, you know, all the cab drivers were Indian dudes. You know what I'm saying? And they just thought it was funny. And I thought it was funny, too. And who named him? I didn't name him. I think even Dave from De La Plug 2 or Dress, one of them named him Jabib. It was probably Dave.
Too funny. And I have to ask, and you certainly don't have to get into this if you don't want to, but I know ages ago there was a little bit of a beef with Ice Cube and the West Side Connection. What was that about?
Oh, I was stupid. That's long done. I don't know. Like, you know what I'm saying?
I would imagine everyone's over it by now.
Yeah, it was some shit back in the day still. Like, yeah, we were really nervous about the situation. Like, knowing the gangster dudes mentality and shit. Like, you know what I'm saying? And for us New York guys, you can't really play around like that because, like, we don't have gang activity and shit, but we have definitely the beef and mentality. Like, oh, you have a problem with me? Okay, next time I see you, it's on. Like, you know what I'm saying? There's like, there's no talking. It's on site. Like, you know what I'm saying? So that was a big thing for us. And we were really worried at that time and shit, to be honest with you. But Cuba's a fucking good dude, man. Like, you know what I'm saying? They got mad because, okay, hear me out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think that they were mad. You know what I'm saying? But Tip said on a 95, DJ Doo-Wop, he made these tapes. I think it was him. I don't know. Well, Tip sent us some tape at the time because it was all West Coast. And we were going to come out. We were about to come out with on Beats, Rhymes, and Life and something else to come out. And so he was like, Tip said something to the effect of, West Coast niggas, we going to bust your shit.
Cuba unity is not derogative. A Queensbred MC, they can run their gym. To you West Coast haters, we will bust your shit. This is how it is, you get blown plus thick. Check it. I denote that.
You know what I'm saying? But like in relation to doing songs, like, okay, we're going to take the industry back. You know what I'm saying? And then them dudes got mad and started saying crazy shit like, yeah, we'll see, we're going to cut your hair and fuck you with a broomstick and all kind of crazy shit. I'm like, wow, dude.
I once knew this bitch by the name of Q-Tip, who claimed he had a problem with this gangster shit. Behind closed doors, running his mouth like a drinking. Took this nigga by the name of Dub, caught him slipping. Tied his ass up and threw him in a truck. Put an apple in his mouth, then dug his ass out. About a month later, they found his body stashed in a trash bag with a cucumber in his ass.
Hey,
are you fucking serious, man? It's like, yo, these motherfuckers are crazy. Like, what the fuck? So I remember, so we had to do this event in L.A. for BET or something like that. And they were going to be there and shit. So we're like, holy crap. So we brought 1,000 people with us. Like, you know what I'm saying? And then I kicked some door open. And it was like Cube and these guys and the other right on the other side of the door and shit. And we were just like, what's up? What's up? And that was it. But I couldn't, you know, for me, it was weird for me because, you know, I'm friendly. You know what I'm saying? And I have relationships with all of these rappers behind closed doors. You know what I'm saying? Because if we're in a party and you meet me, you know what I'm saying? We're in a party environment. You're probably going to want to hang out with me. Like, you know what I'm saying? Because, you know, I have fun. So, Cube is Del the Funky Homo Sapiens' cousin.
Right.
And at the time, me and Del is the homie. Like, Del is the homie. Del's been the homie. So I met Cube through Del. Like, you know what I'm saying? So I'm like, okay, how much beef? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I know it's not that much beef. I know you don't hate me, Cube. I know you don't hate me. Like, you know what I'm saying? So it's kind of weird. And I'm just glad those things just didn't blow up to more than they had to be in that climate, because that climate was so dumb. Because, like, none of the actual rappers really had any fucking beef. It was just the media and shit saying that they had beef. It was so stupid.
Yeah. And, you know, finally, the two things in your life that have been constants since you were a preteen have been making music and cooking. And I assume you've had a lot of time to think about the ways in which they are similar and their overlaps. What have you come to realize about the similarities between them?
Ah, oh, man, it's a lot of similarities. The main one right now, which is really cool, is like, you know, chefs are the new rock stars now. You know what I'm saying? So that's really fucking cool. You're only as good as your last record. You're only good as your last dish. You know what I'm saying? The immediacy of the reaction of it. When I put on a dope song, you immediately start bobbing your head like, ooh. And if I give you a fork full of some food, put it in your mouth, you immediately gonna go, oh, like, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You get a chance to correct it. Next record, next plate, you get a chance to correct your mistake. You know what I'm saying? Last plate was fucked up. Last record was fucked up. Make a new one. If it's dope, everybody'll forget about the last one.
Yeah.
Those are a lot of good ones, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. And what does Eats, Rhymes, and Life have planned for this summer?
Barbecues, rooftop parties, luau's, pool parties, Taco Tuesday. You know, where we got some, it's going to be a great summer.
Awesome. Well, Jarobi, thank you so much for hanging out with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
The first time I met Jarobi, it was unsurprisingly at a restaurant, Marcus Samuelson's Street Bird, right near Crosstown Studios. In retrospect, the location makes perfect sense. Street Bird is a restaurant run by a respected chef, and one that also has serious hip-hop bona fides, decoration by Say Adams, photos by Jeanette Beckman, and inspiration from Dapper Dan. Jarobi, too, is serious about both food and music, and is now able to balance his passions in a way that makes perfect sense. It was amazing to hear about the early days of Tribe and to get Jarobi's unique perspective on the group's career. I also loved hearing about how he was able to make a life both inside and outside of the music business, and how he was always able to do what he enjoyed. The Cypher is still on our summer schedule, so join us in 2 weeks when our guest will be Scotty Hard. Scotty is an engineer, producer, and musician who is involved in the making of a lot of your favorite records, from De La Soul to Wu-Tang to Ultramagnetic, all the way to Medeski, Martin, and Wood. Make sure to listen to find out what record making looks like on the other side of the glass. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow, where you can help us out for as little as $1 a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
He would call me 9 o'clock in the morning, like, yo, man, you know, where can I get a blunt from?
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
It's the easiest shit I've ever done in my life.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Yo, how did you get those beats like that?
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Like ultra, 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 ultra Black Power panthered out.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Walter Thomas.
Everybody thought I was fucking crazy.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Yeah, it would be amazing to play. It would, but I don't. Okay, so I can stop this now, actually.